Welcome to the Higher Education Researcher. This is a podcast by the Center of Higher Education Research and Evaluation at Lancaster University. My name is Felipe Sanchez, and my guest today is Onur Orkut. Onur is a doctoral researcher in higher education at Lancaster University. He's an actor that worked in different mediums and spaces in Turkey and in the UK. Currently, he's a course leader for the PG Cert Learning and Teaching in Performing Arts at Rose Bruford College. Welcome, Onur.
Hello, thank you.
Today we will talk about his research piece published as a working paper by Ciri. There he creates a conversation with Uta Hagen, channeling her book Respect for Artists. Respect for Acting. Oh, wow.
Acting,
that was,
yeah.
That was more difficult. For everyone out there, sorry, this is my second language. For the audience out there that haven't read the paper, could you briefly talk us through it?
So this came out of an assignment that I was doing for the higher education doctoral program, and it was it's for learning and teaching sort of enhancement, really. And I wanted to look at the way that books talk to us. You know, for context, you know, I worked in conservatoire style drama schools for over 10 years now, and the books that we tell the students to read and the books that we read are quite it's a conversation between the writer and the reader, basically. And I wanted to challenge some of the notions in the book. But of course, there's no way of challenging them because Uta Hagen is long dead. So I wanted to have this sort of fictional conversation between Uta Hagen and myself so that I could challenge some of the concepts that she introduces in the book as if she was there, and you know, critically analyze it, therefore. So that was the starting point. Although I did start to write it as a sort of a conventional academic paper, I realized that it just didn't work. So one night I was reading it, and literally overnight the idea came to me that I should actually write it as a dialogue, as an argument, as it were. So that was the starting point.
So the paper so far is written as a play, right?
Yes, yeah, it's a play for reading.
So in a sense, how did you channel Uta?
Well, actually, it's not that hard because she gives a lot of information about herself in her books. So she tells us about her life and her lifestyle and her beliefs and her friends, what she does, where she lives, what she eats, even what she cooks, what she wears. So there is a lot of personal information firsthand that she writes in the book. Now, whether that's true, absolutely 100% accurate, is another matter. But I don't think that really matters, because when we read the book, we read the book. So, you know, we don't have a way of checking it, whether what she ate that day was true or not, or what correct. But the image that she presents is a self-chosen image. So she chose to present herself in a particular way. So I take that as read, really. And then, of course, I used external sources, you know, starting in fact from her obituary back to any records that I could find about her life and where she lived, and other analyses of acting techniques. So there are analyses of acting practitioners from female perspectives, not much about social class and acting technique, but so there are some external resources that I did use. But fundamentally, I think there is more than enough information in her own book for me to channel her, luckily.
But why her? Why this book?
Well, Uta Hagen's book, I mean, it's just one of those books that we do, I think most of the acting schools do prescribe in the first year of acting. So it is one of the fundamental, she's one of the fundamental practitioners of acting technique. And it is based on Stanislavski. It's relatively modern, and it is being used still to this day as in the reading lists of first year acting students in drama schools. So we still teach this book. Well, we don't teach the book, but we tell the students to read this book, and there are exercises that acting practitioners and acting teachers still use. So In a way, that is where my, general research lies. These books that we teach are from the past, as it were, and we still teach them without much critique of them and without much challenge to what is happening. There is some emerging research, but I don't think it's quite there yet. So I wanted to start with it's a compact book as well. It's not very long. It's about 200 something pages, so it's compact. It claims to give exercises to the actor so that the actor can work on themselves alone. Although that's contradictory, and I do go into that in the paper. So it's meant to be a manual for the learning actor, or it's anyone who wishes to become an actor. So that's why I thought it would be a good candidate to be argued with.
So in the paper, you're also channeling Bourdieu's theory to do the critique. Can you walk us through that as well a little bit?
Yes, so I'm mainly using Bourdieu's concepts of capital. So that's my general framework. And what I'm claiming is that to become an actor, whoever wants to become an actor, they need a lot of capital. And whether that be social capital, cultural capital, or economic capital. And probably now in sort of, I think, I don't want to misquote it, but I think he calls it institutionalized capital as well. So that would be the, in higher education terms, that would be the sort of certificate at the end of actor training. And, Uta Hagen is quite, in some respects, she's quite honest about her own origins. And, she acknowledges that she was lucky enough to spend holidays in Europe's castles. And, she talks about having holidays in sort of fancy ski resorts. And, she has a house in New York, in Montauk, which sort of overlooks the ocean. She's got an orange orchard. So she can actually afford the time and the thought, the emotional, mental, physical space to work on a craft and to become an artist. And I claim that that takes a lot of capital. And Bourdieu, I think, mostly refers to that in music and fine arts, but performing arts is sort of left out of it. He does talk about consumption of theatre, but not necessarily making of theatre. So that's how the Bourdieu theory fits in with what I do.
So this idea of exclusion in terms of socio-cultural capital that you're referring to, do you think that this could be maybe extrapolated or done in parallel with higher education and academic work overall?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Because again, the other element of Bourdieu's, which I don't use very deeply, but it's the idea of the reproduction. Now, in acting, this works double. So the capital that I talk about is reproduced in cultural terms, both in and outside of higher education. So what happens is that it's difficult to describe, but what happens is if you go to drama school, there is a vibe to that environment. I guess in Bourdieu's terms, that would be the field. So both in higher education terms and in acting terms, in art, being an artist, being a performer, there is a world, or as called perhaps a tribe of acting, and that is quite distinct. So it's quite distinct. There is a type. Sorry, I was referring to Paul Trowler's Tribes and Territories there in terms of higher education and acting. So even within performing arts, there is a smaller tribe of acting. And if you don't originally belong to that tribe, or if you've never been to a theatre play, or if you've never been in a rehearsal room, or if you've never sat in the wings and watched your mum and dad perform on stage, if you don't come from that world, you have two options. One, you can learn it in higher education and become a part of that world, and you embody all of this capital within 3 years. So you get a sense of it, you begin to operate in that field quite well, and you move on. Or people are reporting, so this is not my research, but Daniel Laurisson and Sam Friedman have written a book on in it's called The Class Ceiling, and in that they talk about these actors who do gain a bit of this capital both after drama school, but their research is more about the profession. So these actors who have lived and breathe in this acting world, the acting field, they still feel alienated. They can't embody it because it's so foreign to them, because they grew up without it. So I think it is absolutely paralleled in a higher education, and there is research separate in higher education about this embodiment of higher education and what someone who goes to university looks like and talks like and dresses like. So I think it is absolutely parallel. It's just, I think it's in a way actor training in drama schools, in conservatoire style training is the worst of world worlds in that terms, because you've got to get adjusted to not only higher education, but to the world of acting.
At the end of your paper, you conclude with a sort of exaltation towards leveling the field in terms of capital volume. Do you think that this can be done?
No. I don't think, I think it, well, I suppose I was thinking about this yesterday actually, because I am actually, well, I am at the moment writing, working on my thesis. So I was thinking, so what would happen, for example, if all of a sudden we made everything freely accessible to everyone overnight? Would that solve the problem? And I don't think it would, because there are some long-learned things, such as, you know, what is good acting? That's a notoriously difficult question to pinpoint. Who decides the good actors? And who decides what good acting is? And why are there so many discrepancies in the acting world? You know, I certainly have my personal opinions who good actors are. And, you know, I can't undo that, really. So I think it needs to be a conversation. And those who want to claim what good acting is should be able to claim it without having to subscribe to pre-learned notions of this is what good acting is, because it moves in time, it moves in medium, it moves in the world geographically, it moves in style. So it is difficult to pinpoint it, but we have to pinpoint it because students get assessed on it. You know, somebody decides whether somebody's acting is good or not, and that results in a module mark, which then corresponds to a, you know, degree classification. And it becomes something that's tangible and exchangeable, something that's ethereal. But then, you know, you read reviewers. I've recently been to a show, for example, you know, I won't name the show, and then I read the reviews, and it was as if the reviewers and I were in separate rooms and watched separate plays. I could not believe that they would, you know, I could not believe how different our views were on this show, and I could not disagree with them more. It's bizarre.
In a sense, the idea of leveling the field in terms of capital, you're also talking about making it transparent.
Yes, and I think that's notoriously difficult, because acting departments should be able to say in very clear and unmistakable terms, this is what good acting is, to be able to assess it right from the entry point to drama schools through to graduation. And if you look at, and you know, you can, this is part of what I've been researching over the last few weeks. So I look at drama schools' audition guidelines and essentially criteria, and there are no criteria. There are very few colleges who, so I'm looking specifically at the Federation of Drama Schools. So I'm not talking about drama departments or, you know, other schools. I'm specifically focusing on the Federation of Drama Schools. And there are no explicit criteria that they say this is what we are looking at. And when there is criteria, it's mostly about the person. So the school websites read, you know, you could read things like, we want to get to know you as a person, and we want to get to know you. We want to see a part of you, how you do things. And I'm going, that's great, but you know, how is that a criteria for good acting technically? And who decides that? And what are the criteria? And there are still norm reference sentences. So they will say, so the public websites will say, don't worry if you don't get in. It simply means that somebody else was stronger than you are. But stronger in what? So they don't, there is no explicit criteria for admissions in drama schools. And there are a few colleges who do publish some kind of criteria guidelines, and then believability comes in. You know, we want you to make interesting choices and believable choices. I'm going, well, believable to whom? You know, what happens if I don't believe it and the person right next to me does? So yeah, I find it, the transparency and assessment of acting, again, I find notoriously difficult. And I've had experiences where, you know, I was supposed to assess a module, and the criteria is believability. And I don't understand how that can be an objective criteria. I think it's, you know, pseudo-objective.
There's also this feeling of how you make acting work more transparent, more equitable, more accessible, less exclusionary. And not to go back to the same analogies that we were drawing before, but there's also an interesting parallel there with academia.
Oh, yeah.
And in a way, you are taking these interesting, complex theories and you're trying to make them also less exclusionary. Do you think that the way you're writing this paper helps in doing that, or how so, maybe, or why?
I hope so. I hope so because I wanted to make this. So when I was getting feedback in the sort of in the draft of this paper, when I was writing it, I really tried to be a good academic, if you like. So I was really trying to write in the language that the academic papers are written in, and I was really trying to be as how can I say it? As I suppose as distanced from it as possible, because I thought, you know, I come from a hard science background, so my first degree is in physics. You know, I in that ilk I can write a paper no problem, and you know, I read a lot of short papers in science, in hard science, because the evidence is so clear that you don't need to write 7,000 words on it. You know, they do controlled experiments and the results are very clear, and they can express it in a couple of thousand of words and it's done, because there's no discussion to be had unless there is some further implications of what the results mean, right? So that's easy in hard science. In certain subjects and in certain contexts, that can be really simple. In social sciences and in sort of academic research that way, you know, I go with the idea that, you know, Marx was forced to call it science because he wanted to be taken seriously in a way. So I thought, do you know what? I want to be taken seriously, but I want to be taken seriously about my experience of this book and how I experience it, both as a past acting student who has read the book as a student, and then as a lecturer who uses the book in the reading list. And my experience affects a lot of people. But again, as I say, I'm not independent from my thoughts, my feelings, my upbringing, my taste in theatre, which again ties in with the Bourdieu. So I thought, and the academic papers always require an argument. And I thought, what better way than for me to argue with Uta Hagen herself? So, you know, I tried to genuinely have an argument with her based on the evidence that she's presenting in the book and the evidence about her in other sources, and literally myself and the theories of Bourdieu. So I had Bourdieu on my side and everything else on Uta Hagen's side, and I thought, all right, let's have an argument and let's write it as an argument.
I mean, that the style, the method is very intriguing to me, and I wonder, how do you select the pieces of work? Because I understand that you have works from the book, from other sources, but how do you arrange them? How do you craft the conversation in a way that represents her thought without her being there? Also understanding that it is fictional, it's a creative work, but it's also trying to represent someone's actual thought. So how do you manage that balance?
I think what I try to do is I try to theme, so that sort of comes from, I suppose, more traditional sort of content analysis. So I try to make themes for the argument. So I start with my own arguments. So I go, this is what I claim, or this is what I think is happening. So I start with that, and then I try to find as much evidence as I can, both to support it from my side, but also to destroy my own argument from the other person's voice. So that sort of gives, I think, a robust enough opposition. So, because what I'm claiming is that this book is very far away from those people who don't come from a privileged background. So that's my argument. And that's quite singular. I'm on my own there. There's nobody to support me. And I go into the book and I try to find as much opposing argument to that as I possibly can. So the primary source is the key. So I want to read the book and I write Uta Hagen's work. You know, I try to find in the book, where can I find the evidence that the book itself says, I am not written for those from privileged backgrounds only. So that's the backbone. So I find the backbone of the argument, and then I try to find as much evidence both ways so that I can write an evenly weighted dialogue between the two sides. So that's how I select. And then themes begin to emerge. For example, in the book, there is a theme of knowledge. that Uta Hagen claims. So she claims that actors should have knowledge of objects that they use in the play. So the characters might be using certain objects in a play, and she claims that the actor must have knowledge of these objects, first-hand knowledge. And almost exclusively, she gives examples of objects that are very expensive. So there is a certain brand of a knife, for example. She says you need to know the difference between an expensive knife and a cheap knife, so that if you're using the expensive knife on stage as the character, you know how to use it. And she talks about an ashtray. It's an ashtray from Tiffany's. She talks about slippers. They need to be elegant slippers. So the actor has to have knowledge of this. So that's a theme in her book. And then as I read and write the book, themes begin to emerge, and I try to pocket those themes and then argue them in those pockets in what I write.
What do you see are the advantages, but also the limitations of this sort of style and method?
I think the advantage is that I find it quite clear in creating the argument. So if I'm not being clear, I can see it as I write, because I can read the other side and I'm going, that's a weak argument. And I'm trying to make it as strong as possible, the counter argument, by trying to make it as supported by evidence as I possibly can. So the argument becomes very clear, and it becomes very clear if it's weak or not. So I think that's, to me, that's the biggest advantage. And the lack of evidence becomes really evident. So if I lack the evidence, I can't argue. So that's the I would say that's, to me, that's the biggest advantage of writing in the style. The disadvantage is, I suppose it can be quite, if I'm not careful, then it could be quite one-sided, and it could be quite subjective, and it could lack the foundation, as it were. But I do try to write it as a, I almost want to emulate a courtroom, so if there is a lack of foundation to what I say, then I can go back and edit that. And the other disadvantage is, where and how to find all this evidence, because it's endless in a way. If I wanted to make an argument, I can make sense of the evidence, but then, Uta Hagen's life is, in this particular example, is as a sea of knowledge, and I have to dive in and try to find the minutest details to be able to make sense of what she's saying. And as a concrete example, for example, I had to find, this is more recent, so maybe it'll make more sense. So I am looking at Stanislavski in this sort of bigger piece of work. And in his there is a letter from him, so it's we know that it's his personal information. And he says, I have this much money, and that I want to, that I can't risk. But he names the amount, so it's, I think it's 300,000 rubles. But the date is 1897, I think. I don't want to again. Yeah, so it's 1897. He claims to have 300,000 rubles in capital, and he uses the word capital. So I go, great. So then I have to find what that means in 1897's Russia, in terms of spending power and, financial capital. What does that mean? Is it a lot of money? Is it? Is it an insane amount of money? And then I had to use some conversion information from the time. And I did have personal correspondence with some Russian researchers to finally come to the conclusion that it actually equates to something like $5 or $6 million in today's money.
Wow.
So he had that. And that was capital that he says, oh, I don't want to risk it. It's all invested, and I don't want to invest it in a theatre because it's my personal money. And I'm thinking that's quite a so to find that information was so revealing for me. Imagine having £5 or £6 million sitting somewhere, and you wanted to start a theatre today. And that's quite a privileged position, I think. And of course, he chose to start a training company because, again, these are in the letters that he wrote to his colleague. He says, I want to start an educational company because it would have more clout and it would have more backing. So again, he's using education and its implications to support his position. But this is the kind of evidence that I'm looking for to make sense of what these writings mean, because Uta Hagen's saying, oh, I want you to have a knowledge of a Tiffany ashtray is meaningless by itself. So I have to dig way deeper into what's happening. And I think that's one of the disadvantages of working in this manner.
So thanks for this interesting conversation. Just to start to conclude, to wrap up, what's next for you? What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on my thesis. So I'm trying to, this time, my argument is with, I'm actually in the writing, I'm not arguing with Stanislavski, but I'm arguing with academics. So my thesis is, this time, is about Stanislavski and the technique itself, acting technique itself, being exclusionary because of the same reasons. You know, an actor, a student actor, has to have the time and the mental, emotional, physical space to work on his or her or their craft. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment. I'm very near, I'd like to think, the end, so it's getting there slowly. And then I've recently been accepted to a symposium on Stanislavski to present a practical demonstration that actually stemmed from this Uttarhagen analysis. And that practical demonstration I have been using in, you know, when I was working as a lecturer, I have been using as an assessment item. And it demonstrates that the actor, even if the actor has no knowledge of the scene context, if we give the right context to the audience, the actor just goes through the mechanical motions, but the audience feels something. So I'm trying to prove that this over-reliance on the internal commitment of the actor is not always necessary to create good acting. So I have a bit of a long-drawn battle with how exclusive acting technique is, and you know, how to make it more accessible without the need for this, especially cultural capital. However, I do recognize that the social capital will always be required. You know, you do have to have the networks and you do have to know people to get into shows or, you know, to stay in the industry. But at least cultural capital and economic capital wise, I think acting technique could be more inclusive.
Well, thank you for that. Any final message for our listeners?
Not really. The only thing that, you know, it might amuse people is I have, when it was on, and you know, this might be slightly off topic, but so what I'm trying to claim is actually was demonstrated in the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial, when they had representatives from one of the major film companies, and they were, because there was a claim about Amber Heard and Jason Momoa having chemistry in Aquaman or lack thereof. So the technical person who was from the production company's side was asked whether Amber Heard and Jason Momoa had chemistry on the screen, and he said no, they didn't. So he was asked, well, how did you create that chemistry? And he said, with good editing and good music. So you know, I think this the notion of good acting is not entirely reliant upon the actor. And there are so many other contributing factors, both on stage and on film, that I think what I'm trying to do is bring the attention of anyone who's engaged in theatre that it's a trick, it's trickery, and it's good trickery. It makes us feel things and it can be cathartic. It can be a wonderful experience if you're an audience member. But it doesn't have to be so taxing and so exclusive. So yeah, that's my message. So I would say, you know, don't be afraid to look behind the curtain. Like, it's like learning the trick to the magician's act. And sometimes it's okay to know it, and it doesn't take away from the magic. So especially if you're interested in acting and want to become an actor, then don't be afraid to look behind the scenes and the, you know, learn the trick, and it's okay. I think that's not that's fine.
Well, I just want to reiterate that this brings into imagination all sorts of parallels with higher education, in the sense that we all know about the imposter syndrome and all this idea of how you acquire this capital to be feel like you belong in academia. I feel like in a way you can also take this message and extend it towards academia and say, maybe we can also look behind the curtain of academics, and they're all not perfect, they're all not socially knowledgeable,
absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, no, that's, you know, the parallels are very, very, to me, they're very significant. But I've chosen acting because that's the realm that I work in higher education. And, you know, drama school acceptance process could even be very, very daunting. I've sat through thousands of people's auditions, and you can see how fragile they are and how, how nervous they are in being accepted to a school. And that's even just the beginning. And even today, I did audition, I still audition for professional shows, and you get to meet other actors in the waiting room, and they are nervous. They You can see it, you can hear it. I get nervous when I audition, so it's unending. And I think the same is true for academia. I was very nervous to write this paper originally because I wanted to do well, and I wanted to write it in the acceptable format. I wanted it to be sophisticated and all of that. But I actually only could do that if once I abandoned a bit of fear and I thought, you know what, I'm going to be authentic to myself, and this is the way I understand it, and I'll do my best to include the evidence, but I'm going to write it as a play. So you're absolutely right. I think it's we can look behind the curtain, try new things, and that can still be academia and that can still be good. It's just not conventional, but that's fine.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Onur, for this conversation. I hope everybody out there enjoyed it as much as I did.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, and hope you stay tuned for the next episode.